Welcome back to A Pint with Peter, as we journey through the 80s, exploring the transition from punk to new wave. And we talk about iconic bands such as Blondie, Talking Heads and Human League. So let's get back to it.
Curb your bad habits, learn from my mistakes. And we finished off last time. Russell's going to shout at me in a minute. We finished off last time talking about the demise of punk, didn't we? And I definitely am going to talk about what was called New Wave.
Mm. Don't want to disappoint the listeners.
So, I mean, you guys, I mean, you know your art. I mean, that term New Wave, it can apply to painting, can certainly apply to cinema. But I'm going to focus on the new wave in music. I mean, new wave was very much a genre in the first half of the 80s. And what it did, it mixed rock music, but it mixed it in with a punky kind of attitude. So punk was not by any means completely forgotten. If you speak to anybody who's a devoted punk, even in late middle age, they will say, come on, matey, you mustn't make out that punk kind of disappeared. Punk was alive and well in the 80s, but it was fading. And I think if you speak to your punk aficionados, you'll find that a lot of the better punk albums actually came out in the early 80s, but it was going. And what you had was a mix of music, but it had, this is what interests me, a pop sensibility, because I think if you were a musician, you probably looked at yourself and you were thinking, this is all very well, but I'm playing gigs in greasy pubs and small venues and so on, and my album or my single isn't going to make the charts. Do you know what I mean? Does this mean anything to you?
No.
Recognise the riff? Well, these are the archetypal, I suppose you would call them New Wave in a way, synth band, called the Human League.
I know the Human League.
I have mentioned the Human League before, but that song to me, I'll talk about it a bit more.
Was it almost making it more commercial?
Well, definitely, because for me, and I've pulled out some of my albums for you, the key, to me, I could mention 20 or 30 acts, but to me, the key acts, if you're thinking New Wave, you're thinking Blondie.
Mm.
I mean, I think it's a middle-aged thing. I can go into a restaurant, or I can be in a lift, or God forbid, I can be on the end of a telephone to somebody, you know, the kind of thing, your call is important to us. Yeah. And you think, no, it fucking isn't, you liar. And it'll have this kind of music on, won't it, Blondie? To me, and I have actually, believe it or not, seen Blondie in their early kind of iteration. She's Debbie Harry, and she... I've seen many front people in bands, but she, like Madonna, had star quality. And she, I've got to say, I mean, I'm not saying I'm a lech or anything, but when I saw them play back in these early days, she was amazing, and she was quite static on stage as well. And if you look at the guys, have a look at the fashion. She liked the ties.
It kind of reminds me of my prom outfit.
Yeah, it's kind of almost going back to those 60s bands, isn't it? Where they, because I think a big feature of the 80s was irony, which is a very difficult thing to explain. And the other, I liked Blondie, but my all-time favourite, New Wave favourite from that era was Talking Heads.
It's a very simple album.
I've got all the Talking Heads albums upstairs, but I've chosen this one because if anybody was there, I can't remember an awful lot about it. But weirdly, Free Trade Hall, I reckon it would be 77. Blondie with Talking Heads. And Talking Heads were, I think, although this album is called 77, I don't think this album was actually out published. I think they were rehearsing songs on this album. And the one standout moment for me, you must know this track, Psycho Killer.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Psycho Killer?
Yeah.
David Byrne, I mean, American. David Byrne is actually from Scotland originally. I think his family moved over to the States. But seeing David Byrne do Psycho Killer was absolutely amazing, because he typical of that era. He wasn't a brilliant dancer, but he had got like a really jerky movement. So anybody out there, if you were actually at that gig, which was a very long time ago, but to me, bands like this, Talking Heads, Blondie, they had their roots in the 70s, but they were playing music that was very different to punk. And the other one, that was a massive, massive thing with me. I've still got friends now who swear by them. This is a go-to act, is Elvis Costello. And again, Elvis Costello, you never mean, I've mentioned this before, in Manchester at the time, this would be late 70s, this is Elvis Costello's, I think it's his first album, it's called This Year's Model. He's an ugly sod, isn't he? You know, he's not up there with Debbie Harry, is he, or whatever. But, you know, the Curry Mile, what I call the Curry Mile. I mean, I remember distinctly, you'll have to erase it if I mentioned on a previous podcast, but you go down the Curry Mile and there were big six-foot-high posters of Elvis Costello. Wow. Either in that pose or he was literally doing an Elvis pose, you know, with his legs spread apart and everything. And, that was his kind of introduction. I've seen Elvis Costello two or three times, and you know, people out there who know the Manchester music scene, I've just seen Elvis Costello at a place called Rafters, which is just down the road from when you get off at St. Peter's and you've got the that was called Rafters, and I've seen several bands there.
That album cover's not a misprint, is it? That's what makes me think of.
Yeah,
just because the E's cut off and you got a colour banding. It's like, has Dad literally got a super rare album?
No, not at all. I mean, I'd like to show these is because I know you two guys are obviously very interested in design. I mean,
that one's interesting.
I could bring the whole lot down here, but this to me, this is. That kind of printing. This is called the Imperial Bedroom album, and that to me. I don't know if you know the guy. You know Basquiat. You know the painter Basquiat, New York. That to me is very, very Basquiat. So they were my biggies, but I'm proud to say one of the bands I was fortunate enough to see. Unusually, I saw these babies. This is called Television. These are called Television. These are uber. At the time, that they were uber cool, and they had a punky kind of element. This is Richard Hell. Yeah,
I don't know why I get indie band vibes from.
Yeah, but that's the point. I think
Oasis.
I think new wave, post punk, blah blah.
Oh, Killers, yeah.
You could probably attach five or six labels. It's just a question of picking the one out that suits you on a particular day. But you know, Richard Hell, you know what his real name was? Richard Lloyd. Yeah? And this guy is called Tom Verlaine, not his real name. But Verlaine was a French poet. But that, I'm just giving you a vibe of the pretension of the time. But
I feel like I want us to have punk names.
But What you should have picked out here is all those bands are basically American. American, and yet again, it'd be lovely if somebody who's a real dyed-in-the-wool punk could call in. I have a thesis that punk basically originated in the States. And I think he came over with Malcolm McLaren, blah, blah, blah. I think to a very great extent, a big part of the whole, the new wave thing also came over from the States.
Do you think some people get insulted by that? If you met a punk and you were like, it's out in America, they'd probably get quite...
Yeah. Well, people, you've got to remember, people like me, back in my hippie phase, you would have been very anti-American. All things American were anathema. Don't ask me why. I mean, it's just a piece of kind of youthful stupidity, isn't it? But television, I mean, they were a change of shift, a change of purpose, a change of style. They toured England with The Clash. They opened for Elvis Costello. And they also toured with The Pistols. Hmm. Yeah. And
would you say they made it big, or they just never...
Television, not commercially, no, but I reckon if you spoke to your average 18, 19, 20-year-old who's into music, they would know who Television were, because I think they were groundbreaking.
What, in the generation then?
Yeah.
Now.
Oh, now. No, I think Television are real. I tell you who Television, again, shoot me down, remind me of. The Strokes.
Yeah,
do you remember from your era, that kind of New York-y cool vibe?
Yeah.
And the music was very slick, and it kind of chopped and changed around. This is Richard Hell. This is a wonderful book. I know you guys like the title, don't you? I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. Great title, isn't it?
He kind of looks like that comedian. Pete Wicks? No, what's his name? American, not very funny.
He's on, no, he, you know that, you know, SNL.
Yeah.
So I think there's an American look. I think if you look at The Strokes, for example, that to me is an American look, isn't it?
Yeah, or he has kind of a Pete Doherty look.
Absolutely. Well, not now. But not now. Pete Doherty recently. But
maybe he does look like Pete Doherty now.
But
or is he dead, Dad?
No, he's not. He luckily, I mean, he... did, I think, maybe one album with Television. I might be wrong. They fell out, inevitably, him and Tom Verlaine. And he formed another band that also toured England. I didn't see them. It was called Richard Hell and the Voidoids. They were very, very, very much, again, an indie underground thing. But I remember I was working in Urmston, I think it was, at the time, and somebody had obviously been along to this Voidoids concert, and they'd got up on a roof, and they'd put in 3-foot-high capital, Richard Hell and the Voidoids are God, you know, so... Yeah, you had big fans of music like that. But
when I think of punk gigs, thinking about that, the front man would always say, climb the rafters and stuff. That was something they do even back then.
Do you know, that's really, really interesting, because I was going at some point to talk about, at some length, for an iconic Manchester band, which of course were Joy Division. And I was lucky, I guess. I've only seen Joy Division twice at very small gigs. And early Joy Division gigs, Ian Curtis, I don't know how much you know about Ian Curtis. He was the lead singer, but I'll come on to his story a bit later. But they basically, and you must have seen bands like this, you're kind of trying to figure out, are these people being cool? Or are they just dead nervous? Or are they being dismissive of the audience? Because they basically would, you know, amble onto stage. You maybe would get an hello, good evening, and you maybe would get a goodbye, and that would be it. Hmm. They just played the songs.
I'm sure I've said on a previous podcast, I hate when bands do that.
Yeah.
I love it when they have a bit of banter with the crowd. Yeah.
They just go through the songs, and Ian Curtis, this is really common knowledge. I mean, he eventually committed suicide, and he had an epileptic condition. So when he danced, if you get some clips later, it was very kind of jerky, as with David Byrne. But David Byrne was doing it as an effect, you know, whereas with Ian Curtis, it was something horrible was going on. But why I've got that I Felt Like a Clean Tramp book out is, I think Richard Hell, I think very intelligent guy and also very arty. You know what I mean? During the punk era, I think a lot of the punks were actually very arty and quite intellectual, but you hid it. You know what I mean? You didn't want to be seen to be like that.
More the intellectual side, because I feel like the arty side's okay.
Certainly the intellectual side, but if you read that book, I think it really gives you an idea of the almost distaste and disdain that, if you want, genuine musicians had for punk. Yeah, my friend Andrew in the States, I mean, I won't mention him again, but if you look at any list of new wave bands, I mean, a biggie would be, and I haven't brought their albums down, would be The Police. And if you look at bands like The Police, and if you're talking post-punk, if you're talking U2, there were bands from that era. You know, they might have been new wave, they might have been, you know, post-punk. They also had incredible popular appeal. You know, both The Police and U2, they must have sold millions, and they would have sold globally. Do you know what I'm saying? These bands a little less so, but even so, big hitters. You didn't have that really from any punk band. Maybe The Clash, maybe the Sex Pistols very briefly. But when Richard Hell toured with the Pistols, he's one of these buggers who would have kept a journal, and part of that book is from his journal, and he talks about touring Britain. I saw Talking Heads, by the way, supporting the Ramones, would you believe? I was more interested in Talking Heads. That was the Electric Circus. I think the big difference in styles, punk, the attraction of it was it dealt with real life. Do you know what I mean? Down, nitty gritty. This new wave stuff offered something upbeat. It offered something with, if you want, standards and values rather than boredom. And interestingly, you could dance to it. You could suddenly, it's like, you know, if you know your history, you know how the Puritans and Roundheads vibe, You know how the Puritans basically, you know, they just stopped theatre, didn't they? And all that kind of stuff. It's a bit of a, it's not an exact parallel, but people could suddenly dance. And the music, you know, of Blondie, of television, of Elvis Costello, up to a point, you were talking about something, it wasn't about failure, it wasn't about depravity, and it wasn't about ugliness, you know, I mean, you can only sell that stuff for so long, yeah? Mm. So, when Richard Hell met Sid Vicious, remember the infamous Sid Vicious who took over, he described him as a comedy of helplessness and uselessness, sort of guy who saw a crazy opening into fame and money. He just needed to relax into full loutish negativity to achieve what he thought he wanted. Yeah? Totally infantile and clownish in his fucked upness. I mean, that's a pretty bad indictment, isn't it?
Yeah. Not a positive review. No.
So as I say, I think New York, because there was stuff coming out of the West Coast, but I think for me, the interesting West Coast stuff was in the earlier hippie days, you know, the Summer of Love and all that. You had Andy Warhol, amazing influence. I mean, what do you guys know about The Factory, Andy Warhol's Factory?
I actually know, because I watched a documentary on it. It's quite good. It was almost like a compound, as we've discussed before, wasn't
correct.
It?
Yeah, yeah. It actually had three or four kind of iterations. But the thing about Andy Warhol and The Factory, it obviously wasn't just painting. It was about dance. And I've got to say, you know, I used to go into a pretty dodgy part of Manchester to that art cinema. I've actually sat through, and I'm a pretty patient guy, I've actually sat through several Andy Warhol films. Now, I'm going to ask Chris, have you ever watched or do you know much about Andy Warhol films?
No, because I don't have that much patience for that type of art.
I feel like they would be those type of films that you watch them thinking, this is shit. But yeah. but then at the end, around all your mates, you're all like, oh, it was amazing.
No,
I
don't think I'd have the patience. I've walked out of the Tate Liverpool before because it
have you?
Yeah, I was just like, I can't be doing with this. Wow. I'm way outside.
I always like to picture an angry Chris.
It's called Art House. I'm going to try and remember one. I think I've seen Heat, for example. It's basically just people lying around and saying things, and no, nothing happens. Mm. Nothing happens. And that's, I guess, supposed to be ironic. But
I mean, we went to the Guggenheim and made fun of. Is it the Guggenheim?
Yeah.
In New York, you made fun of most of the pieces.
I mean,
did you?
They had a massive block of ice melting in the foyer, with surrounded by microphones, and the art was they were recording the sound of ice melting.
Wow.
There was just a pure black canvas.
And I was about to say, there's a pure black canvas and a pure white canvas.
Mm. And that was it.
And they're the pieces that stuck out for me as high bullshit.
It's interesting you guys say that because there's a part of me, I'm not going to do it right now. I would probably, to a far greater extent than you would, I would actually, in a way, defend some of that stuff, because what you're talking about essentially is conceptual art, isn't it? Mm. I remember way back, I went to, because I used to go to London much more, I went to Tate Modern. I remember it was at the time when that pile of bricks was there. I don't know if you know this, it was just a pile of bricks. That was iconic. And the furore that caused in, you know, the Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph was, you know, basically, what the fuck are we spending taxpayers' money, you know, thousands on this rubbish for? And I think you've still got that vibe now, haven't you?
I think what I saw in Tate Liverpool, what made me walk out, was very similar to the pile of bricks. It was some breeze blocks and some scaffolding rods. But it's just like...
I just can't get my, like, I love art. I'm trying to think of one that I thought, oh, that's quite good.
It's like in The Simpsons with Homer and his barbecue.
Yeah, where he tries to put a barbecue together, completely fails, and an art critic is like, oh, it's so emotional and raw.
Wow. Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, maybe we could divert the podcast into talking about art. Mm. Appreciation, because funnily enough, I really enjoy the work of an art critic. He's called Wojcicki. He frequently has stuff on Sky Art. Very, very knowledgeable. He's knowledgeable about the Renaissance. I was watching a program the other day about Mannerist art, you know, which is around the time of the Renaissance. But he can also talk about modern stuff. And he was recently discussing the Turner Prize. And I think in the end there are five or six entrants, you know, who have a chance of winning it. And at the end of the article it said, you know, I don't mind A, B or C winning, but for God's sake, I hope it's not this one. And the one that won, it sounds a little bit like what you've been talking about. It was Union Jacks and fencing poles and bits of found objects stretched across four galleries. That's not what you're talking about.
No.
Okay. Anyway, punk, England, this is Richard Halligan's, to me, seemed defeated and ashamed. I found British people were cynical, self-deprecating ironists. The death row oppressiveness of urban Britain. And this is the thing he picked up on, with its chip shops and bad drugs. So that'd be a really good title for a podcast, I think. Chip shops and bad drugs. If you think being an American, you know, I'm sure even then they didn't have a vast variety of takeaway food. But if you think about it, every town, every village in Britain in the 70s, late 70s, probably even into the 80s, would have had a chippy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You well, think
even if you go to America now and you go to like an English pub, there's always fish and chips on the menu.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
I always think it's a Chinese now. I always remember going to the most remotest Welsh town and it had a Chinese.
Yeah.
It had a Chinese.
But it's a Chinese that will... This is interesting because if you've read... I don't know if you've read Angie's book.
No.
But it's basically about that, about growing up in a Chinese
takeaway. Is it a friend of yours?
Yeah.
Somebody you know?
Yeah.
Was it serialised on Radio 4? Yeah. Oh, yes, I know it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Takeaway. My childhood Chinese takeaway, I think it is. But it's called Takeaway.
Yeah, she took a lot of abuse, didn't she, in many ways? The family did, yeah, disgusting.
Yeah.
Oh, that was really, really interesting.
But she talked about in the book, like, how even in the remotest part of Wales, there was Chinese, and it would be like family members go to different parts and set it up, and like, there's a little community of them.
Wow.
It's interesting, but it's like a dying...
Really?
Think now because the younger generation don't want to take it over.
True that.
Yeah, that's a very 80s thing, by the way. I'll come on to that. How in the 80s, even ordinary people, it was almost a sin to be normal and ordinary. To me, it was in the 80s where all these job titles shifted. You know, the classics where nobody was, a bank clerk or a dustbin man or whatever. All the job descriptions changed. So you kind of twisted it around to sound really interesting. Mm. I mean, to me, the whole punk thing, it was exaggerated. There wasn't much art success. But this is the thing in art, you can be talking painting or whatever. It led to wonderful developments in the 80s. And I get a feeling that many acts just held their breath and they waited. And not my bag, but in the 80s, you had the rise and rise of mainstream bands like Dire Straits and Queen. But your dad likes Dire Straits and Queen, maybe?
It does, yeah.
And bands like that, they're a real presence now, aren't they? Queen. Yeah, I heard, the guy who played Oppenheimer.
Killian Murphy,
indeed. Yeah. I mean, he was on Desert Island Discs, and sure enough, he had a Queen song in there saying, and he's what? He's 30-something, I would have thought, isn't it? Maybe 40, maybe 40 now. But, you see, punk was provocation. And I think at the time it was a really potent form of if you want to be pretentious, socio-political critique, but the content wasn't really there. It was all surface, and in the end it was pure scam, pure sham. So I much more liked this kind of music, the indie stuff, and I think it would have influenced you two in a way, because I think the music you listened to grew out again of new wave and new romantic stuff. Do you know what I mean? It's any art form, it's kind of organic, isn't it? It kind of grows into, it mutates into something new.
I was not going to bring this up because to avoid a tangent, but I was
like tangents.
Well, it literally reminds me of someone I was listening to this week about metal, and I think it was metalcore.
Oh yeah,
because it was something similar. Like around our generation, metalcore bands were kind of becoming a thing, and the guy doing the description described it as metal was something you'd listen into a dingy pub. But this metalcore is like, you'd go to a club, because the music is like has a synth wave.
Interesting.
It's talking about partying, doing drugs, but with the metal screaming.
Wow.
And all the old metal people hated it, even though these bands were just as heavy as the bands they'd listened to. But because it was that slight change in culture, they were like, no, it's shit, rubbish music. it isn't metal. They just kind of reminded me of what you're saying about punk, that even though there's slight alterations, a lot of the old
punk, the old guard, yeah.
We're like, no, yeah, this isn't, yeah, you can't consider, yeah, it punk.
Yeah. 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 That's, yeah, I mean, I, you're probably not going to put this in the, you're not going to include it, but I pop in to see my brother now when I go back to the Midlands, and he, this time around, he was adamant he was going to play me some thrash metal, doom metal, I think it was called. Jesus, I mean, I'm very tolerant, but it was basically bass. Bass and some drum and somebody basically screaming at the top of their voice. Yeah, it made Slipknot seem like high art. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's one of the genres I never got into. I feel like my friend Jack was quite into it a bit.
Oh, okay.
But if he ever put it on, I just pretend to like it.
It's real.
Maybe if I ever put it on for you, Chris, you're like, no.
it's kind of. It is headbanging, isn't it? It is headbanging.
Well, it's like sometimes it's described as pig squealing. Like, that's what. I bet if I said that to your brother, he'd be like, "Oh yeah, pig squealing."
Wow. Yeah. I'm going to see if he'll desist next time. I'm going. Anyway, the 1980s. Yeah, Thatcher. What interests me getting onto this Seven Ages of Man thing? The 80s. What I hope is, I'm talking about what was going on before you were born, which really interests me. And
nothing, Chris. The universe didn't exist.
But when I was putting these ideas together, I stood back and I thought, wow, the 80s, you know, 30-odd years ago. 30, you know, keep that in your head, 30-odd years ago. Somebody like me, I was born in the 50s. This is what I'm driving at here. I know it doesn't quite gel, but what I was thinking was, as a 50s boomer, you know, if I was sitting there with my hoary forebears, you know, my great-grandfather and great-grandmother, I don't remember very well at all, but I did, in fact, you know, speak to them, in a semi-equivalent way, think about that 30-year thing. I was born in the 50s. They could well have been talking about the interwar years. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, for me and your mum and for your parents, Chris, the 80s, without being nostalgic and all that bollocks, they're not so distant. I mean, I met your mum in the 80s. But in a way, when you guys are listening, it's like me as a much younger person, somebody talking about the 1920s.
It's quite weird when you put it into that.
Am I making sense here? But I really thought, wow, you've got to remember that, Peter. I mean, it was critically, even in the 80s, it was an emerging technological age. You know, you had Space Invaders. Mm. That's the level you were at, Space Invaders. And I reckon you might have had prototype phones, but mainly in America. You know, as you moved into the 80s, the mobile phones were present, but certainly you'd have to be very rich to own one, and they literally were like bricks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of A Pint with Peter as we journey through the sounds of the 80s. I hope you enjoyed the memories and exploring the cultural tapestry of this pivotal decade. As always, you can get in touch with us. Let us know what you think, your favourite tracks from the 80s, or what do you remember from that decade. You can email us apintwithpeter@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @apintwithpeter. Well, I guess, on to the next one.